greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on Joshua's Long Day when we come back. You know, we Americans are the most litigious people in the world, and we believe in our lawyers with a kind of religious fervor. And we've been taught from early childhood that he who represents himself in court has a fool for a client. But what would you say if a plumber said that? What if your plumber said, he who fixes his own pipes has a fool for a client? What if your carpenter said, he who fixes his own steps has a fool for a client? Now, doesn't our common sense tell us that a plumber or a carpenter who couldn't fix his own pipes or his own steps is incompetent? Well, my common sense tells me that a lawyer who can't represent himself has to be just as incompetent as that plumber or that carpenter. Now, listen to James Nielsen. He's a professor, a law professor at the Hastings Law School. Here's what he had to say about our lawyers. He said it's a fact that a student can graduate from this, the fourth largest law school in the United States, without ever having written a pleading, without ever having written a contract, without ever having written a will, without ever writing a promissory note or a deed. And he said it's worse than that. Most students graduate from this law school without ever having seen a real, honest-to-God pleading, contract, will, promissory note, or a deed. And a student can graduate without having set foot in a courtroom, without ever having spoken to or on behalf of a person in need of advice or counsel. And a student can graduate without once being exposed to the operation of the rules of court. Now, whatever else may be said about this license issued by the state bar, let it be said that for these students and their clients, that it is a cruel hoax. Now, that's Professor James Nielsen of the Hastings Law School. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call us here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it. Now, that's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free. Now, courtroom strategy and procedure, our school is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, why don't you go to our website? It's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and then send an email request for that free general law CD package. Do it right now before you forget. That's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about Joshua's Long Day and the arguments that higher criticism has levied against God, the Bible, and the whole concept of could the world stop for a whole day and then start up again? Well, in the ordinary sense, we would say, well, no, in our lifetimes, we've never seen that occur. It's never happened in my lifetime that I know of. But it did happen one time in history. You know, you and I are pretty well attuned to our world. We know that spring comes first, and then comes summer, and then the fall, and then winter. What would you think, though, if you had spring, winter, summer, fall? You know, if the seasons were out of place, you'd notice it right away, wouldn't you? What if the sun rose in the west tomorrow instead of in the east? You know, you'd notice that right away. one of the arguments that was made here by the critics, you know, was that the world couldn't stop. Now, for some reason, an airplane that travels 1,000 miles an hour, it can decelerate and stop, and it can start up, and it can accelerate to 1,000 miles an hour without killing the pilot. Somehow or another, though, if the world did that, why, it would cause chaos, and it's impossible, and it violates natural law. I'm not so sure that our investigation so far has verified these critics' assertions. In fact, I took a little time and we went through that. Yes, it's true, when an airplane traveling 1,000 miles an hour stops suddenly, you know, in about a half a second, yes, it causes a lot of damage. That same airplane, when it decelerates over a period of 3 or 4 minutes, causes no damage at all. In fact, if you've ever flown on an airplane and you've felt the acceleration and felt the deceleration over a short period of time, it doesn't take hours, just a minute, you know, from the time the airplane touches the runway until it stops, you know, at the end of the runway, it's less than a minute. Same thing with the takeoff roll, you know, just next time you're on the airplane, just when the pilot pours the coal to it, you know, just take a look at your watch, and in about 30 seconds, that airplane's in the air. So the acceleration-deceleration argument's about as phony as a $3 bill, but none of us were there, so we don't know exactly how it was accomplished. But the guy that was there was an eyewitness, and he said, now here's what he did. It's contained in 271 words. It's in the Bible. It's in Joshua chapter 10. Joshua chapter 10. And we have reviewed Harry Rimmer's book concerning Joshua's long day. Harry Rimmer's book, remember, was The Harmony of Science and Scripture. And then he referred us to the Joshua's Long Day book written by Professor Totten, who did the astronomical calculations back in 1890, based upon the eclipses that occur. And he goes into that in some detail here in his book. It's a little dull reading, but it tells us the answer, and it gives us the facts that we need to know that this is a true, accurate, and correct historical phenomenon, which was perpetrated and created by a real God. You know, a real God, as opposed to all of these phony gods that we have, that we worship and we pay a lot of attention to. This is what in the Bible is called the God of gods and the Lord of lords and King of kings. Well, Totten goes on with the inception of the problem. He says, the writer was led to make this calculation not to find out whether the account was true, but rather because it was conceived, or he was convinced, that it was in fact true, and that it could therefore be proved to the satisfaction of any reasonable man. And I mentioned this to you last time. Key here is reasonable men. Critics aren't reasonable. And now it may be further stated that in the course of his studies and calculations, he has been led to see that the collateral fraction of an hour, 40 minutes, required by the turning back of the shadow upon the dial of Ahaz in the days of Hezekiah, also forms an integral and necessary part of human chronology and must be resorted to, or restored to it, in order to work the cycles of astronomy with absolute accuracy. Now, you've probably heard this before, you know, the sun, the earth, when they're in their orbits and they're working properly, work, you know, the earth goes around the sun and it goes, oh, hell, they got this thing measured down to about 4/10 of a second. 4/10 of a second. So it's pretty accurate. 40 minutes is a lot of time compared to 4/10 of a second, wouldn't you say? So not only did God stop the world, he left 40 minutes of it out, and it's not quite 40 minutes, you know, it's an odd amount. And then it goes right down to 4/10 of a second, and he restored it to right down to the 4/10 of a second. How do you like that? The fact is, there can be no compromise in the position of a believer in the Bible, and we freely grant this to the agnostic as the essential substance out of which the only bridge whereon we can hope to meet and draw up the preliminaries of an eternal truce must be constructed, and we equally insist upon its employment by the Gnostic. And that is, we fully recognize the logic of fundamental common sense, and we maintain that all men of sound mind, that it can be fairly demanded of the Bible, and that it shall square itself to its own record, when tried at the bar of most transcendental astronomy, since by the premises of creation and inspiration their authorship is one. Now at present, however, we're only dealing with Joshua's long day, and we are not yet called upon to divulge when, how, where, or why the addition of a fraction of a single hour became astronomically necessary and was actually intercalated in the calendar. It was demanded in the calculations which verify the whole, all this in its proper place. The problem whose solution was primarily undertaken was this: whether a conjunction of the sun and moon occurred in the celestial vicinity of Beth Horon at midday during Joshua's life. Now here are the chronological conditions. The chronological conditions imposed upon the problem by the sacred record required that this mid-heaven conjunction should have occurred during the first 5 years of Joshua's occupation of the land, somewhere between 2553 and 2558 A.M., that's, remember, after man was created, that's A.M., and within these years, the special geographic astronomical conditions required that by reversing the cycles of the three bodies, the sun, the moon, and the earth, from their present positions, their relative places should be such as to bring the sun over Gibeon and the moon over Ajalon within the set chronological limits. And that is, the question to be settled was whether astronomy would in fact corroborate history. Now the Battle of Beth Horon must have occurred during the first 5 years which succeeded the passage of the Jordan, which occurred on Friday, the 10th of the 7th civil month in the year 2553 A.M., and which preceded the division of the land. Caleb was 40 years old when he was sent out with the spies. We read that in Joshua 14, verse 7. Caleb was 85 when the land was divided. We see that in Joshua 14, verse 10. Hence, the division was effected 5 years after their occupancy of it, and Caleb must have spent 40 of these remaining 45 years in the wilderness with the rest of the host. For example, from the middle of 2513 A.M., the date of the Exodus, to the middle of 2553 A.M., that of the entrance into Palestine. The Battle of Beth Horon could not have occurred after the division of the land, for long before that event we are expressly told in Joshua 11, verse 23, that the land rested from war. Nor, of course, could the battle have occurred before the passage of the Jordan River. We are thus confined within very narrow chronological limits even before we undertake the crucial test of pure astronomy in order to find out the exact date which satisfies the rigid conditions directly imposed upon us by the record itself. These conditions are as explicitly fixed by the account as if it were committed in so many words to a transit of Venus upon the Beth Horon high noon in question. So, in the account given in the 10th chapter of Joshua, we find the sun is placed upon the meridian of Gibeon, 35 degrees, 10 minutes, plus or minus, east of Greenwich. Which latter place, Gibeon, lies east of Beth Horon by some 6 minutes, plus or minus, of arc, while at the same time the moon is located upon the meridian of Ajalon at 35 degrees, 2 minutes, plus or minus, east of Greenwich, at about an equal distance of arc, 6 minutes, plus or minus, to the west of Beth Horon. So the moon was therefore recorded as about 8 minutes, plus or minus, west of the sun, and had the relative motion of the three bodies. Not been arrested, she would have come into conjunction, for instance, become a new moon, in about 13 minutes of time. Now, if the account is to maintain its integrity, and faith, of course, believes it will, while infidelity never investigates at all, unless it be under a predisposition to find error, we have here at most consummate set, or a most consummate set of astro-geophysical chronological conditions which must agree with the present positions of the three bodies to the very last degree of accuracy, and that they actually fulfill these complex conditions and are rigidly true to the cycles as unrolled down to the date of the last sun-eclipsed conjunction in history, which was June 17, 1890. And my own calculations verify this beyond any doubt. He's got a number here, 60 to the 7th power here, and I'm not quite sure how that fits in. But the calculations verify to 9 this, or to 60 to the 7th power beyond seconds of time. I'm not quite sure what that means. Now, the reference to the moon is anomalous, but right here it's proper and it's apropos to insist that the mere mention of the moon under the circumstances involved at Beth Horon is a positive and prima facie guarantee of historical accuracy of this whole account. Now, as it was at midday that Joshua found himself at Beth Horon, and the moon, both by modern calculations and by the tenor of the record, was so near to the sun, for example, at that portion of her orbit where she is always invisible even at night, there is no human probability that the moon would have been mentioned at all had not the facts of the case both warranted it and demanded it as a necessity. For about 27 and a half hours, both preceding and following a conjunction, the moon has no phasis, and the Bible account places her within 15 minutes of the sun. Right, let me pause here. You know, ordinarily we can't see the moon in the daylight. Once in a while you can. There are times when I've seen the moon in the daytime. But he says it's coming into conjunction here. So the moon was about to become a new moon. So it had been in the going down phase, and it was just about to become new moon in 13 minutes. You can't see the moon. And yet, here's Joshua 10 telling us that the moon was here, although we couldn't see it. Joshua could see the sun, he couldn't see the moon. The reason that Joshua 10 brings that conjunction into the text, remember those 271 words, with specificity is so that later on that this could be proven astronomically. For instance, you take the Messiah's birth. You know, everybody gets real excited, you know, about Christmas. And Jesus was born on December the 25th. If God had intended for us to keep his birthday or wanted us to know when his birthday was, he would have given us these astronomical waymarks or calculations. Remember the story about the three wise men come, and they said, well, we saw his star. And people have been thinking, well, there must have been a star. There must have been a comet, or there was some kind of a sign in the heaven, but it's not mentioned like this one, so that you can actually go back and you can identify it. That star, I think, was an angel that led him to the inn, but then that's another story, you know, for another day. The wise men never showed up at the inn. They showed up months later at his house, but that's another story for another day. The point I'm making here is that in the Bible, from time to time, you'll see astronomical calculations. You'll see where God says the moon was here and the sun was there. so that, you know, 1,000, 2,000, or 3,000 years later, some guy like Totten can come along and then run this gearbox backwards or run it forwards and then come to a conclusion and say, okay, well, when that happened, here's where the gears were lined. He says, bathed in such a meridian sun glare, the moon would have been invisible even to the Lick telescope. And nothing but the veracity of the fact will ever reasonably account even for her incidental introduction into the record of this stupendous effort of the solar system. But being there, and being moreover an essential and ruling element of the Hebrew calendar and the method of keeping it, the whole system of sacred terrestrial chronology demanded that the moon should be involved in the same mandate of silence imposed upon the sun under penalty, if not of throwing all the writings of Moses into unutterable confusion. For these writings are strung together historically in terms of a lunar calendar, pure and simple, while at the same time their chronology is intercalated in order to keep solar time also. Hence we have held the sun, which did not rule the Hebrew working calendar, and to have suffered the orb that did so to pursue her lost way, would have necessitated an entire re-editing of the first five books of the Bible, or else have required all future generations to correct its chronology by the use of a constant of the most complex mathematical character. Such a stoppage, therefore, as Joshua was led to request in Joshua 10, verse 8, demanded a stoppage of the moon as well as of the sun. For example, the earth's rotation and the moon's orbital motion had to be equally controlled. It is to this fact alone that we are indebted for any mention of the moon, and so her absolute place in her orbit is as positively fixed by the record as is that of the sun, which was, after all, the ruling light so far as merely Beth Horon's battle is concerned. All right, so let's pause right here and let's understand another little vital factor. Not only did God stop the earth, he stopped the moon right along with it. So he stopped both of these bodies. So if you think stopping the earth was a trick, then he stopped both the earth and the moon. So he stopped the moon in its orbit. How's that for a plan? And then he stopped the earth in its rotation on its axis. How's that for a trick? He did it for 23 hours and 40 minutes, 23 hours and 20 minutes, leaving 40 minutes to be accounted for 1,000 years later. Well, not quite 1,000, but pushing that. Now, the real effect of such a stoppage, the effect of the stoppage of all relative motion among the three bodies for about a whole day, was merely to introduce a single weekday into the calendar, and this was effected by the Hebrew priests when, then and there, as a separate and distinct measure of the duration of the stoppage itself. But insofar as the actual measure of celestial arc is concerned, it could not and it did not lengthen the then current year, 2555 AM, or the lunar year, 2634, by anything whatsoever. That is to say, the year, the lunation, and the terrestrial rotation were severally completed when they were suffered to resume their speech at the very same points of the zodiac which they would have reached had the incident not occurred in the first place. If the power of God had enforced this silence on the spheres for a whole year instead of for a single day, the cycles themselves would bear no evidence thereof today, save only to mark as they do now the fact and date of the conjunction at which it was recorded to have occurred. For example, to have begun and ended for the logical and astronomical carrying out of the mandate requires no change of relative arc measurements while the silence continued. But accurate chronology would have borne true evidence of the fact and of its duration. If so be, it should have been as well preserved by the priests, who were the calendar keepers, as they did preserve that of the single day which is recorded to have actually occurred. For instance, a similar stoppage of all relative motion among the three bodies in our day today would be very accurately measured by the chronometers of every observatory on planet Earth, and by the watches now carried by every one of us. And undoubtedly, such a stoppage, as to its duration, would be measured and accounted for in terms of weekdays, each of 24 hours, and be given its proper place as such in the current calendar. But save in the terms of such weekday periods, we would have and could have no other record of it, for the cycles, when resumed, would inevitably finish their respective courses at the identical points of the zodiac they would have reached had no such relative stoppage been imposed. Thus all astronomical record of the stoppage would be lost so soon as motion was resumed, unless history and chronology should have independently kept watch of it by geographical references and by time measured in some other way. So I maintain, therefore, both logically and astronomically, and also as a chronologist, that the sole question which modern astronomy has to ask of these three bodies is now moving and duly recorded by their elements in the best nautical almanacs of the day, is whether such a conjunction as the record demands is also demonstrated to have taken place at Beth Horon within the limits which are equally set forth by the account. Beyond this, the yea or nay of astronomy cannot go one single element of arc, which is its only measure of time. But right here, accurate chronology steps in, and the testimony of chronology has the casting and deciding vote in the matter. For if it shall be shown that while the elliptical points reached by the bodies that rule the times and seasons are the ones duly demanded by astronomically recorded time, while nevertheless the points reached in the sequence of the weekdays, for example in the calendar, which is the sole province of chronology, are ahead of the astronomic ones by an amount just equal to the alleged duration of the stoppage as recorded by history, then the demonstration of the problem is complete in its mathematical, and it cannot be gainsaid in the least by anybody of sound mind and reason. It is thus manifest how beautifully history, chronology, and astronomy stand related to each other in preserving the record of human duration, and how consummately they may mutually assist one another in defying those who would belittle the accuracy of the infinite and infallible word as it is written. Now to continue, he says, not before nor since Joshua's long day has there been a date which will harmonize the required relative positions of the sun, moon, and earth as conditioned in the sacred record and reversed from their present relative places. So we are here limiting ourselves to the most transcendental accuracy, and we are ignoring a numerous group of perpetually recurring approximations which to all common purposes bring about a repetition of a midday conjunction at the given place after 19,651 and 5,859 years, for example, in one of the several solar lunar cycles. But it is not enough to determine the least common multiple of a year and a lunation in order to obtain an accurate solar lunar diurnal cycle, for the Earth's own rotation must be rigidly included in the calculation if we wish to tie the repetition geographically to the zenith of any particular place on planet Earth. This, then, necessitates the reduction of a solar day, of a lunation in solar days, and of a mean solar year to their very ultimates, say at least to the determination of the resulting least common multiple and its reduction back to years. Now, if anyone will undertake this simple but tedious operation, he will find, as this writer has found, that the period required is much more than 23.5 quintillion years. Nor, short of this stupendous eon, can the conjunction sought, or in fact any other conjunction, accurately repeat itself at the same place in even its simplest solar, lunar, and terrestrial time elements. With such figures in mind, the search for Joshua's long day is certainly akin to hunting for a needle in the universe, the which is manifestly so much the better in the cause of accuracy. Nevertheless, there it is, and it results equally as well whether we reverse their cycles from the present positions of the three bodies, or work them forward from the solar-lunar conjunction at the instance of that autumnal equinox which marks the first day of Adam's mundane chronology. There's a break right here, boys and girls. Let me give you the mid-course reminder. We are reviewing Joshua's Long Day from Joshua chapter 10 in a book called Joshua's Long Day, written by the astronomer Charles A.L. Totten in 1890. Stand by for more exciting news about Joshua's Long Day. Hey, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Now, The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law, from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, please go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. Remember, the law hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archives. It can be accessed through the website. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, economics, history, health, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call the Law School and ask for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour, an editorial review, gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse or recommend will reciprocate. Most of these authors and publications that we cite on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily 100% endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review either. The opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please visit our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. Or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. And along this line, to give credit to Mr. Totten, who wrote this book, by the way, back in 1890, any references that I looked for in more than 20 years to Joshua's Long Day by Totten or his manuscript was futile. I couldn't find it anywhere. And then one day, I don't know, 10 or 15 years ago, I was talking to a guy named Howard Rand. He was a religious guy up in Massachusetts. He was an old man then. He was in his 90s when I talked to him, about 1990. And he sent me this book. It's called Joshua's Long Day, written by C.A.L. Totten, T-O-T-T-E-N-M-A. M-A, that's the letters after his name. And the book is published by Destiny Publishers. Now, that was Howard Rand's company, or it was his ministry or something. I'm not quite sure how that worked. Rand was kind of a religious guy, I remember that, and I talked to him, you know, on the telephone for 15, 20 minutes, and he said, let me send you this book, and anyway, that's where I got the book. I'd been looking for it for years. Destiny Publishers is in Merrimack, Massachusetts, and their zip code is 01860. Now, I've had this book for 20 years, you know, or 15 or something like that. So I've had it for, you know, a long time, and I don't know if that Destiny Publishers is still in operation. I don't know if it was carried on, you know, by Rand's children or associates. I would guess that if it is, that this book is probably available in a Bible bookstore. A Bible bookstore might have it. If you can't find it in a Bible bookstore, and you can't find it with Destiny Publishers, you go into a used bookstore. It's just a little paperback book I got here. It's kind of like it's almost like a religious tract, only it's a little bigger than that. It's 117 pages. And your chances of finding this aren't going to be very good. Now, this Professor Totten taught at Yale University, so you know if you really want to get into it, I suppose that if we called Yale, see, I didn't even know where this Totten taught until I got this book that told me he was from Yale. So I imagine if we went to Yale University and said, go back to 1890, you had a professor there by the name of Totten. Have you got anything that he wrote? And can we get it? And that might be another source. The other book that I cited from is really a neat book. It's called, and it's easy reading. You know, I kind of made fun of Mr. Totten here. Maybe I shouldn't. But it's not the most easy read, and it's not very thrilling and exciting. These professors don't write nearly as well as The Harmony of Science and Scripture by Harry Rimmer. That's really a gripping book. That's interesting. It's scintillating. It's exciting. It's got new material. I mean, it keeps you on the edge of your seat. And it's that's about 150 or 60 pages, and it may look. That surprised me. 280 pages. It's not very big. 280 pages, about 6 or 8 chapters that deal with science, a harmony of science and scripture. Now, you've heard these guys talking, you know, maybe your preacher, you've heard maybe your preacher or some other preacher say the Bible is not a science book. The Bible isn't a science book. I think it's a science book. I'll tell you why I think it's a science book. And it's because the atomic theory was first brought up in the Bible in Hebrews 11, verse 3. I think that the atomic theory is pretty scientific. Meteorology, gravity, the germ theory, protozoology, quarantine, cytology, life, spectrographic analysis. These are all topics that are brought up in the Bible. Now remember when we saw 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, and this guy Jules Verne, writing back in the 1880s, is describing a nuclear-powered submarine. Isn't he? Aren't those nuclear-powered submarines? And listen, those wetsuits that those guys are, you know, going in and out of the submarine with, you know, aren't those the same thing that we have today when we have these diving, you know, suits, you know, wetsuits with these canisters on the back of them? Now that was kind of a prophecy, wasn't it? Didn't Jules Verne accurately foresee the future and say, well, gee, I think we'll have nuclear-powered submarines and aqua lungs and things like that? Well, if in the Bible, you know, thousands of years ago, you know, even before Jules Verne comes along, you see a description of the atomic theory
meteorology and protozoology, wouldn't you say that either those people back there 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years ago were really smart dudes, or else we are listening to a real God who is a real creator before we learned or discovered these sciences? Now, my common sense says, well, what we're dealing with here is a real God. So when some preacher says that the Bible isn't a science book, well, in strict terminology, it's not a book that's devoted to science, but it sure got a lot of science in it. It's not a necessarily a book devoted to history, but it sure got a lot of history in it. It's not a book that's necessarily devoted to prophecy, but boy, it sure got a lot of prophecy in it. It's not a book necessarily devoted to law, but it's got a lot of law in it. So it's a law book, a history book, a science book, and a prophetic book. It's got all of those elements in it. Now, we're looking at an astronomical problem here. It's not only got astronomy in it, but it's got astronomy that really tests astronomers. How many people do you know have actually gone back and done this calculation? If this guy Totten could do it in 1890, I find it hard to believe that anybody that's got that kind of skill today, 100 years later, couldn't duplicate Totten's work. So if you're an astronomer, why don't you test this guy? The Bible says, prove all things. Don't believe it on faith. Don't take it because I said so. Go prove it. Now, for most of us truck drivers out here, you know, we can't do this. We don't have the mathematical skills. We don't have the knowledge necessary to do this. So God tells us, says, well, at the mouth of two witnesses or at the mouth of three witnesses shall the matter be established. That's the way we work in court. You know, a judge is listening to a case, and the judge, he doesn't know anything about science. But he listens to expert witnesses come in, and he cross-examines them. He listens to the record, and he listens to the witnesses. He applies the Kwok Ting test. And when we get through at the end of the day, we can come to a pretty reasonable conclusion that this guy's lying, this guy over here is telling the truth. This guy's story over here makes more sense than this guy's story over here. We can apply a little reason, logic, and common sense to the equation and see whether or not this guy's telling the truth. Rimmer testifies to Totten. Totten brought up another astronomer that did the same calculations. And in this book, and in Rimmer's book, they both mention other astronomers that took up the challenge and corroborated Totten's work. And so, if we were sitting in the courtroom, we would say, okay, now we've got two witnesses or three witnesses that testify to the same thing. Now, this is a pretty stupendous event. This isn't something that can be done by mere mortal men. You know, we can go out and build a Grand Coulee Dam, and that's pretty monumental. And we can build great works like the Suez Canal or the Panama Canal. But we cannot stop the world, and we can't stop the moon. So, that being the case, if in fact the world stopped and the moon stopped, then we're dealing with a real God here. We're dealing with something that's supernatural. This is not normal, boys and girls. It's kind of like watching the Red Sea part, you know, and you're looking at two walls of water about 110 feet high on each side. You know, that Pharaoh should have looked at that and said, you know, boys and girls, this ain't normal. This is not routine. I think if I'd have saw those two walls of water, if I was one of them Egyptians, I think I'd have been hightailing it in the other direction. Just common sense ought to tell you that. Now let's take a look at the origin of time. It is manifest that if we believe the Bible to be superlatively accurate, the latter method would be the most natural one to pursue. For not only would it pass through the Beth-Horon conjunction, but by producing the cycles onward, would inevitably land us at the places where the several bodies are now found. And this, in fact, as above stated, is what occurs whichever way we work the problem, either from here, back, or from the beginning forward. And hence the logical and irresistible conclusion is that the biblical record is without error, and that henceforth we may assume the Mosaic era as a natural astronomical point in all of the calculations of chronology. Now, when a novice has been conducted systematically through the writings and the windings of a labyrinth to its inner sanctum and has been fully initiated into the principles which govern the correct means of progress, it is manifest that he will ever after refer all localities therein, not to some shifting point in the outlying circumference to which new paths are being constantly added, but will always start his measurements from the one fixed point which governs all the rest. But it is admitted that the novice in our illustration has to be conducted the first time from the outside in, and so it's natural in the confused state of modern chronology to demand of one who maintains the accuracy of the Mosaic system that he should trace his way backward to its origin and take the initiates with him in order to beget in them the confidence that he has himself. So it is trusted that before the present volume has been laid aside, a modicum of this confidence will have been instilled into its readers, and that they will thereafter see sufficient ground whereon to think from Adam down the stream of time instead of upwards from some accidental generation of his everlasting prosperity. But to return to our topic, may pause right here. Throughout the book, he brings this subject up, so it's worth mentioning. He said, no, if you're trying to calculate chronology from today backwards, and you're trying to wind your way through the Julian calendar and the Egyptian calendars and all the rest of these timekeeping modicums, he said, you're going to be pulling your hair out. He said, the correct methodology is to start with Adam and work forward. And then when you get up to 1890, then you take from 1890 and you go back and you check your work as you go through these calendars and through these chronologies. And you'll be able to see where these errors are and make your corrections. So most people, you know, if you're like I am, you know, you look at your calendar up here on the wall and you see that it's April the 13th. And so you look at your calendar and you try to calculate your time and we're familiar with it and I can make preparations, you know, for the weekend, and I can make preparations for writing or doing broadcasting or whatever it is based upon what I'm familiar with and I know. But that calendar, Totten says, you cannot use to go back. You got to start from Genesis 1 and work forward through the chronology. Then it'll take you up to 2006. Now take it from 2006 and work it backward to find the errors. If you start here and you start working it backward, boys and girls, this guy says you're going to be pulling your hair out. All right, now here's an intercalated day. To be scientifically correct, it may therefore be stated that the sun and moon were going into accurate conjunction in the mid-heavens over Beth Horon, as recorded in Joshua, for the 31,604th time. So that number is 31,604 since their primeval conjunction on the first day of Adam's first week of time, on the 24th day of the 4th civil or 10th sacred month of the Hebrew calendar in the year 2555 A.M., which day was a Tuesday at 11:13 a.m., it being the 933,285th day of the world, reckoning from creation inclusive. If you're taking notes here, stand by. Get your pen and paper out here. You'll notice that this guy isn't giving you any theories, and it could be, and it might be, and we think that if all the facts are in and our theories are correct, that maybe it could well have been, that maybe it's a definite maybe. We're getting right down here to where the rubber meets the road. He says, now, to be scientifically correct, it may therefore be stated that the sun and moon were going into accurate conjunction in the mid-heavens over Beth Horon, as it was recorded in Joshua, and here's the number, 31,604. 31,604. That's the 31,604th time since their primeval conjunction on the first day of Adam's first week of time. So, in Adam's first week, we're talking about now Genesis chapter 1, the creation week, began on a Sunday and ended on a Saturday. 7 days of creation. It says you start from there and you start working forward. And that's 31,604. And on the 24th day of the fourth civil, or the 10th sacred month of the Hebrew calendar in the year 2555, so 2,555 years after creation week, which day was a Tuesday, so you can put that down, it was a Tuesday, and the time of day was 11:13 a.m., and it was the 933,285th day. That's 933,285 days of the world reckoning from creation inclusive. Whereas if we reverse the cycles from the latest solar eclipsing conjunction of history, to wit, that of Tuesday, June 17th, 1890, okay, you got that date, Tuesday, June 17th, 1890. They pass unerringly backward to that same conjunction and make it 1,217,530 days ago. If you want to write that number down, here it is again. Tuesday, June 17th, 1890. Calculating backward to Joshua's long day is 1,217,530 days ago. But upon a Wednesday at about 10:33 a.m., for example, there is inevitably about a whole day between these two results. So when you count forward, you come up with 31,604. When you count backwards, you count 1,217,530 days ago. One of them, counting forward, you come up to a Tuesday. Counting backward, you come up to a Wednesday. And then there's your Joshua's long day. There's a day missing. Where did it go? What happened? So, Professor Totten, remember, he's talking to a buddy of his on the campus, and this guy says, I was doing some calculations, and I find that there's a day missing in time. Totten said to the guy, well, why don't you start reading in the Bible and see if that doesn't answer your question. He reads up to Joshua 10. He says, I found the missing day, but it can't be written by any gods, because if it had been written by a god, he would have known that there was 40 minutes missing. And I have to agree with that critic, because think about it. Astronomers and chronologists, when they keep track of time, they keep track of time. Hell, even in the Farmer's Almanac, they tell you when the new moon or the full moon or when the days, you know, whatever they're talking about, are going to happen to at least within a minute. Most of them to within a second, and some of them to within 3 or 4 tenths of a second. In fact, just the other day I was watching the news or something, and they said that they had to put in, I forgot, they added or subtracted off of the atomic clock, something like 1 second. And every so many years, they have to adjust the atomic clock by about a second, because you see the Earth is slowing down as it, you know, it's just friction through space as the Earth is flinging out around the sun. That every so many years, I don't know if it's every 5, 10, or 20 years, or 5 or 10,000 years, it's something, some number in there. And the Earth is slowing down. And so they got an atomic clock somewhere, probably in Washington, D.C., and they have to adjust that. And while they were adjusting it, I forgot if it was a hundredth of a second or a tenth of a second or a second, something like that. Astronomers and chronologists keep time, boys and girls, to hundredths of a second. So in 1890, they didn't have an atomic clock, but, you know, they're keeping track, you know, of time down to the second or down to the minute. And here's 40 minutes missing, and this guy says, hey, listen, what kind of a god is this that he screwed this up by 40 minutes? And Totten said to him, well, why don't you keep reading, sucker, because as you progress along to about Isaiah 36, you're going to find that missing 40 minutes. And remember, it's not 40 minutes either. It's something like 36 or 37 minutes and 54 seconds and then 4/10 of a second. And when God got all through with this project, he stopped the sun, stopped the earth and stopped the moon from revolving around the sun, and he did it to within a hundredth or 200th of a second. Certainly within 1 second, certainly within 1 minute. Otherwise, they'd be able to say, well, when he got the thing started up again, he did a pretty good job, but he's off by about 3 seconds, or he's off by a minute and a half. No, sir, boys and girls, according to Totten here, he got it right down to the gnat's whisker. Now, that says to me that this is a guy that's in control. Kind of reminds me of a pilot, you know, flying the airplane. And he needs to navigate from Chicago to Honolulu. You know, most people, they couldn't find Chicago on a map of the world, and they couldn't find Honolulu either. Imagine the pilot of your airplane, he has to know where Chicago is and where Honolulu is, and then he has to be able to navigate the airplane from Chicago to Honolulu. Now, you talk about one tricky sucker. Those airline pilots are tricky guys. And I don't think anybody would ascribe to an airline pilot, you know, the attributes of a god. This guy, not only knows where Chicago and Honolulu are located, he can stop the whole world that they're located on, and then start it back up again and get it down to within a second. Hell, the airline pilot can't fly that airplane from Chicago to Honolulu and tell you within 5 minutes when he's going to stop on the tarmac. Hell, he'd be doing good if he can get it within an hour. Now, this god over here can start and stop the whole world and get it down to hundredths of a second. An airline pilot can go halfway around the world and he can get it down to, you know, 5, 10, 15 minutes. I'd say that's, we're talking about a real god here, aren't we? He goes on to say, whereas if we reverse the cycles from the latest solar eclipse in conjunction of history to wit that of Tuesday, June 17, 1890, they pass unerringly backward to that same conjunction and make it 1,217,530 days ago and on a Wednesday. So when you calculate back, you come up to a Wednesday. When you calculate forward, you come up to a Tuesday, and that's the moral to the story. And I'm about out of time, so I'm going to make my mark right here in the margin. We'll take it up right there next time. In C.A.L. Totten's book, Joshua's Long Day, giving you the exact calculations so that you can check this out. Don't believe me. And as God says, you ought to prove all things and hold fast that which is good. Well, let me pull my papers out over here, boys and girls, and remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. If you'd like more information about the Law School and Law Hour, please go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, please go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, we're out of time. I've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.